This is Victoria of the UnleashedHeart.com, and you're listening to Grieving Voices, a podcast for hurting hearts who desire to be heard, or anyone who wants to learn how to better support loved ones experiencing loss. As a 30-plus year griever and advanced grief recovery method specialist, I know how badly the conversation around grief needs to change. Through this podcast, I aim to educate grievers and non-grievers alike, spread hope, and inspire compassion toward those hurting. Lastly, by providing my heart with ears and this platform, grievers have the opportunity to share their wisdom and stories of loss and resiliency. How about we talk about grief like we talk about the weather? Let's get started. This episode is sponsored by Do Grief Differently, my 12-week in-person or online program that helps grievers who have suffered any type of loss to feel better. In Do Grief Differently, you learn new tools, education, and a method you can utilize the rest of your life. In this program, and with my guidance, you remove the pain of grief. The sadness will always be there because even in complicated relationships, we love. But it's the pain of grief that keeps us stuck. Are you ready to do grief differently? Check out my website, www.theunleashedheart.com, to learn more. Welcome to Grieving Voices. Thank you for joining me today and listening. And today I have Denise Schoenwald with me. She is a dedicated registered nurse for over 30 years, has seamlessly transitioned into a nationally licensed mental health counselor and published author based in Sarasota, Florida. With a deep understanding of the emotional challenges faced by patients and their families, Denise's holistic approach integrates mental and physical well-being. As a spiritual teacher and certified family mediator, she brings a unique perspective to her private practice, offering support to clients nationwide through virtual sessions. Denise is committed to nurturing both body and mind, providing flexible and accessible care for individuals, couples, families, and even young thinkers starting at the age of 4. Thank you so much for being here. And also thank you for a copy of your book.
Oh, terrific. I'm glad you received it. Welcome.
It's Insightful Self-Therapy, Increasing Your Awareness About Mental Health and How to Live a Happier Life. And I will put a link to that in the show notes. And we'll actually be talking, there's a couple things I have noted that I would like to talk about that you mentioned in the book. But first, I'm curious what brought you into the nursing profession. And, you know, it's in a way a healer profession. What brought you there?
Well, I love how fascinating and sophisticated the body is. So I always saw myself in some sort of nursing. I considered just very briefly being a physician, and I love also helping people. I did, my specialty was critical care, and working with people who are very sick and dying is quite an honor and very stressful. And I just, it was just a wonderful career until I was getting to the point where I was getting too old to do the grind of 12-hour shifts and call and nights and weekends and holidays. And so the transition for me into mental health was an easy one.
What would you say to a young person who is just pursuing a career in nursing?
I think a lot of people go into nursing, a lot of the young people that I meet, because it's a wonderful career. I mean, you certainly have a lot of opportunities. You can certainly do very well financially. But what I really encourage them to do is not to forget that these are people that are going through very tough experiences. And I think a lot of times we get caught with the clinical aspect of ordering meds and titrating drips and so forth. And we forget that these patients are going through something very, very difficult, probably one of the most difficult things they've ever gone through, not only physically, but emotionally and sometimes spiritually.
What do you think is the highest indicator or greatest indicator of a nurse who will burn out in that career? Because it can be a very high burnout rate in that career as well, especially with COVID. I mean, we saw it happening before our eyes.
Yes. One thing, when people are either physically sick or emotionally struggling, they pull energy. They're thinking about themselves. They're focused on themselves rightly so, because they're sick. And as healers and helpers, we understand that it takes a lot out of us to try to help them and nurture them, not only physically and emotionally. And when nurses and physicians and mental health counselors don't do their own work, so when we get home, we have to recover from that with self-care and exercise and rest, then we're likely to burn out.
In your book, one thing I jotted down was, and I didn't really think about this in terms of how we can inflict suffering on ourselves, but I think there's actually a book, The Four Agreements.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah, yeah. But you mentioned in your book the importance of honoring commitments. And when you think about the flip side of that, of dishonoring our commitments, and one of the commitments can be self-care to ourselves, right? Just self-care. Yes,
I agree.
But can you speak a little bit about the importance of honoring our commitments?
If you think about relationships, the only thing that we rely on with each other is trust. And when I tell you that I'm going to do something, or you tell me that you're going to help me with something and you don't do that, that really betrays my trust. And so that's difficult to recover from. But what I find more frequently is people and individuals really don't honor themselves. They don't get enough self-care. They don't. Sometimes when I talk to patients about self-care, they say, I don't have time for that. And I say, well, you'll either make time for self-care or you're going to have to make time for illness, because the body cannot sustain if we don't nurture it. And I'm not really sure why, as a society now, we're neglecting our own self-care, for sacrificing it for helping others.
You know, there's been periods of time in my life where I've been guilty of sabotaging my own self-care. It's like in those moments of like extreme challenge or being confronted with something really challenging, that's when you need to double down on your self-care. And I think I've had to learn that lesson several times. Like, okay, this is when I need to really double down on taking a break and needing a mental break. And so I'm glad that you mentioned that in your book. In that same vein, there's another aspect of your book where you talk about the importance of emotional intelligence. And I think as we develop that emotional intelligence, we have that obviously more self-awareness when we realize that we're self-sabotaging our own self-care and things like that. What have you found in your practice has been helpful for people that you've worked with and even for yourself in developing emotional intelligence?
Here's a very easy way. One is notice, not judge. Notice how, as an individual, that we're starting to act. Are we all of a sudden very irritable? Are we going to the refrigerator one too many times for more food? Usually when we're very stressed emotionally, we go for sugar and carbs just automatically. Watch how much we're drinking. If we're smoking, watch how much we're smoking, because the body is trying to balance. And if we're not doing healthy things, the mind becomes very active and we start reaching for things in the environment that are unhealthy. Spending too much screen time. It's something that the body is trying to find ease. But unfortunately, if the mind's in charge, it's likely not going to be a good choice.
My personal go-to is anger. So when I'm like, just this last week was a doozy of a week. I had some credit card fraud on my website. And it's like, when I thought the week couldn't start off any worse, it snowballed. I've lost access to my business Facebook page. Like, it's been just technical, like stupid stuff that, I actually like the Facebook page thing was my own stupidity, not realizing what I was doing, but it's really created a lot of anger to come up inside me. And I find that when I'm angry, and I would love to talk about anger more, because I think it's a really important emotion that we have. But when I find that I'm getting angry, I don't eat, I don't drink, I don't want people to even talk to me. Like, don't talk to me. I just, I need to sit with my anger. Mm-hmm. And I know not everybody's like that. Like a lot of people will just, that, like you said, they'll reach for the refrigerator or they'll go shopping to distract themselves. But for me, it's like, it doesn't come out very pretty either. So like, how do you reconcile that? Like when the anger is coming out and up, it's like, and you have people around you and you don't want to be, you know, you don't want to be a jerk. Mm-hmm. What is your advice for that? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there listening, like, that's me.
Yes. One of the things as a therapist that I do when I meet someone is I'm trying to figure out where they are emotionally. Like, where is their emotional frequency? It's actually measured in something called Hertz. Anger is around 150 Hertz. So it's a low vibrational energy, but it's got a lot of intensity. So anger, ego, jealousy, they're all around the same sort of frequency. And when we get to that point, we likely are going to say something or do something. We can no longer hold it in. And after we say something or do something, likely we feel either very guilty or shameful about how we just acted out. And then many times we feel very sad and depressed. Both anger and shame and depression are take a lot of energy from the body, both very extreme emotions. For me personally, when I want to say something out of anger or ego, let somebody know how I really feel, I remind myself not to say a word. Because even if I do, it's not likely going to be well received. I will say, however, right now, I really don't feel like I'm in a good place to talk about this. I would like a little time to, you know, think about it or whatever I want to say, just to give myself a little bit of space, knowing that I'm going into very dangerous territory because I'm already pretty darn angry.
And it's not even like I'm getting angry at people around me. They're just trying to ask me a question and I'm just mm-hmm. so wrapped up in my own anger that I can't even have a conversation. But you bring up a good point. So one of the service offerings I have is biofield tuning with mm-hmm. tuning forks. And so it's mm-hmm. interesting that you mentioned the hertz of anger, because I never thought personally to get out my tuning fork, maybe just come to my office, light a candle, and, you know, just strike my fork.
Yes.
A few times.
Get that vibrational energy to go to a little bit higher.
Yeah.
To get through that anger. Yes. The other thing is underneath anger, and when I work with little children who have anger issues, I pretend it's an umbrella. And I say, what's underneath the angry umbrella? I'm frustrated. I'm overwhelmed. I'm disappointed. And I try to give them some language so that it doesn't just come out in door slamming or screaming or calling names. And I go, okay, let's think about what's under the angry umbrella. It's actually very helpful for me too.
I will probably remember the umbrella the next time, because I'm sure this issue that I'm dealing with is not over yet. And so I'm suspecting some more anger will pop up as mm-hmm. a result. But thank you for that. I also want to talk about people pleasing, which you mentioned in your book too, because just this past weekend, there was a skit on SNL. Ariana Grande was on, and it was a people pleasing support group skit. And, mm-hmm. you know, it kind of was making fun of the people pleasing, but it was interesting that SNL is addressing this on their show. Mm-hmm. Or talking about it on their show in this way. But, you know, what people were saying was, oh, no worries, you know, because they had their lines to say. And mm-hmm. one of them was, no worries, whatever you decide. And, you know, what do you think? Well, I'm okay with whatever you think, you know. And so it was kind of exaggerating things, right? But mm-hmm. I heard myself in what they were saying in some of these things, mm-hmm. like, no worries, you know. What are some techniques for people to stop themselves when to recognize, again, it's developing that emotional intelligence about people pleasing first, but mm-hmm. what are some suggestions that you have for people to get out of that? First of all, why do we do it? And then mm-hmm. secondly, how do we stop it?
Well, the reason why we do it is when someone's unhappy or they don't have something, it causes us a lot of anxiety and we want to go in and fix it. And I might say, well, I want to do it because I want to help them. But what I really want to do is make myself feel better about it.
Mm.
And so we have to be careful of that. And so what I tell a lot of people is when somebody's unhappy or they're going through something, you can be supportive without fixing it. Because sometimes when we please, the other person gets very resentful and frustrated because we're coming in and we're trying to just rescue and take care of when that's not what they've asked for. They're just letting us know they're upset about something or some situation. But what happens with people pleasers, if we can imagine drawing a circle, and inside the circle should be our personal values and ethics and what makes us different from the next person? What is it that we know to be true about us? And when we meet people, they will figure out fairly quickly what's inside our circle, what our values are, and they will like us or not like us or align with us or not. Doesn't mean one's good or bad, just means we understand and we appreciate each other or we don't. The people pleaser circle has a lot of gaps in it. And what happens with them, unfortunately, is they will fall prey to people who are very manipulative and controlling. Because somebody who's manipulative and controlling, they're masterful at finding a people pleaser. And so when the people pleaser pleases, they'll walk away knowing that they really may not have wanted to do what they just volunteered to do. And then they get a lot of, they betrayed themselves and they also have supported somebody to be very manipulative and to be very unkind. And that is really hard on the body. You can see why.
Mm-hmm. So in the dynamics of friendship and when we think about grief, and what I hear a lot too is, and I know people that have had this personal experience, but when you are going through something really challenging and you're reaching out to people and they're not showing up in a way that you need them to or mm-hmm. are asking them to, how do you reconcile that where, I don't know how I'm trying to ask this, because it kind of revolves around people pleasing. It's like what if two people pleasers, I guess, you know, if you're two people pleasers and then one person has like a really difficult time and needs the other person and yet they just can't do it. They're not able to support you. And so how do you reconcile honoring where someone else is at, that they just can't support you in that time? Because this can happen with grievers too a lot, right? Yes. Like this is where friendships kind of can break down and break apart because people aren't showing up for you how you hoped. Can you speak to that a little bit?
And I think with people pleasers, I think sort of the fear is that they're going to hurt or disappoint someone. And what I try to do is help them with language. Because you can express how you feel without being insulting or dismissive. What I have found with grief is many people get very uncomfortable with grief and they don't know what to say. So they will say something very insensitive, not meaning to, but they can hurt your feelings because they just sort of speak out of fear and then they say something that is very hurtful. So what I tell people is, understand that it's just a very uncomfortable situation and a lot of people don't really feel comfortable navigating it. If they're offering something that you really don't want or won't appreciate, it's thank you so much. That's so thoughtful. Maybe next week would be better to drop off whatever, some food or something like that. It's always complimenting and appreciating, but then also letting them know what would work best.
So you bring up boundaries in a way, in a roundabout way.
I do.
So I actually wanted to talk about that because you have a great exercise for creating boundaries in your book. You mind sharing that?
Well, is that about the circle? Is that what I talked about the
circle? Oh, yes. Yes, you did. You did touch on that when it came to,
Yes. And so what I tell people, when your circle is clearly defined, You don't have to defend it. You don't have to over-explain it. You don't have to get nasty when somebody, but people will test boundaries. They want to know like what you will accept, what you won't tolerate. It's very important that we all understand that. As a therapist, as you can imagine, I get a lot of good experience and practice with boundaries. People are, can be very manipulative, and why can't you do this? And why can't you see me there? And I say, listen, I would be happy to. Unfortunately, I'm not able to do it today, but I certainly have time tomorrow or Wednesday. If that's acceptable to them, they go, okay, thank you very much. If it's not, that means that they're not, that there's no boundary there. They don't, they would prefer that I don't have boundaries, and it's not going to be a good fit. I don't want to support them to be manipulative and abusive, nor do I want to run myself to the point where I'm exhausted and I'm no good to anyone. So I honor them, and I also honor myself with boundaries.
I was just going to say, and that's where a lot of helpers get themselves into trouble is, yeah. And that ties in with the people pleasing, right? Where you just, you want to be supportive, you want to be helpful. And it's often to your own detriment when you're not recognizing or acknowledging that boundaries are healthy and they're good for both parties involved.
They really are. And if we don't have boundaries, what we end up doing is being very bitter and resentful, because we feel like people are taking advantage of us, and they are, but we're also allowing that. So we also have to take responsibility for that. And again, it's getting comfortable just having these conversations nicely, and then allowing the other person to accept it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. What I like what you said about grief too, you know, when you get to that point where all these things just kind of, where you realize you need boundaries and you start honoring your own commitments and you're recognizing that you're a people pleaser and you're doing all these things and you have all this awareness, you can find yourself in a lot of grief just because, like you said, when you start implementing these things in your life and having these awarenesses, it can rub people the wrong way. And that's where these, you know, friendships and relationships can deteriorate as a result. Mm-hmm. And there's grief in that, especially if it's been a long time friend or whatever the scenario may be, or even a marriage or a partnership and things. Yes. I like how you said grief is, it's like you can become stuck in the waiting room. Mm-hmm. And so many people get stuck in the waiting room. And me personally, I was stuck in the waiting room most of my adult life. Mm-hmm. I was a child griever. And like, you know, you carry that stuff with you from childhood into adulthood and all the trauma and the mess and the baggage, right? You carry it with you into adulthood. And I mean, only in the past 5 years have I had this leaps and bounds of self-awareness and growth and reconnecting with my own intuition and my own knowing. But can you speak to the philosophy you have about that, and then about treating grief with medication and your philosophy around that?
One of the things about grief, and I tell people this all the time, there's no way of going around it. You have to just go through it. And we get so frightened of pain. But also with pain, as I try to remind people, and this has been helpful in my own life, I try to look for meaning. Because what you said was so true about relationships. People that you think will show up for you sometimes don't. And people that you think really didn't even know you that well will show up. So grief will cause this major shift. And what you're going to get from it, hard to say. And it's just something that it just surprises me. But what I tried to find through my own grieving times is, how can I come through this a better person? One thing about with death, even back when I was in my critical care days, is boy, I had such an appreciation for life and relationships and so forth. Also, for me to be more compassionate when other people are grieving. We tend to go to the funeral and maybe check in once, and then we go on to our daily lives. But yet that's when it's the most difficult, you know, when things start to settle down. And so I've make myself a mental note to reach out to a lot of people that are grieving and suffering, just checking in. not offering to help, not offering to just say, hey, how are you doing? Giving them that space to just speak their truth and how they're feeling. It's very important.
Do you find working in the mental health, or the area of mental health, and obviously with grievers and things like that, do you find, because I'm feeling like, you know, there's so much heaviness in the world. There's so much sorrow and suffering, really.
Suffering. I agree.
It's like, I feel like sometimes I just want to, cocoon myself. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, when you work in this space, it's like, sometimes I think to myself, do people expect that I should do or behave or respond a certain way because I'm the grief expert, or I work with grievers, mm-hmm. or the mental health expert, and I'm, you know, working with patients and families, and I know all this stuff, and I'm a helper. Like, how do you reconcile that for those listening who are helpers, who are working in this space? Because to me, sometimes it feels like too much. And that's where I know I need to then maybe address some self-care within myself. But can you speak to that a little bit?
It's very true. And so when you're finding that it's all so overwhelming and it's so heavy, we need to go in and go, okay, what do I need so that I'm sort of in a better fitness state to handle and to share space with this person who's grieving? But, you know, at the end of the day, we're all human beings, and it does affect us. Just because we don't know this person or who's lost somebody doesn't mean we don't feel that energy. That energy that their experience is pulling. They're pulling from us because they want support and they want help, and they're struggling and they're suffering. And yet that's going to take a toll on us. You asked me before about medication. You know, that's something as a nurse, I understand that sometimes medication is needed, but we also have to go through this grieving process. We're not going to get around it. We can try to numb it a little bit, but it's very, very painful. Some people can't survive it. They've been married 50 years and their spouse dies. They tend to go right after them because it's so heavy on the heart in particular.
Yeah. Thank you for circling back to that question. And even for me personally, it's not even that I think, you know, it's not even people reaching out to me, asking me, but it's like this, I feel like this, maybe a sense of duty in a way. Mm-hmm. And then I feel guilt when I don't. And so that's a little bit hard to reconcile for myself sometimes.
Well, and sometimes you need to make sure you're in a good space to, like, for instance, if people that don't know that I'm a therapist, if they catch me at the grocery store, I'll say something like, listen, I'm really sorry this has happened to you. Why don't you give me a call so we can meet privately or something like that? I just don't know that I'm in a good mental space to have this conversation, you know, standing in the deli aisle, whatever, and so forth. And so I understand that it's important to them, but I also have to make sure that I'm in a good place because I want to give them my 100% focus, and I'm not in a good place when I'm out doing errands and so forth.
Yeah. And that's great advice for the helpers listening to this.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We all sometimes have to go through that challenge.
We had talked before we started recording, talking about grief. And one of the things I'd like to talk about is supporting kids, because you had mentioned that there's been a lot of loss for your children, mm-hmm. or your son over the years and throughout his school years and into adulthood. And I think one of the things that hasn't really been talked about a whole lot from a mental health standpoint is supporting kids who have lost friends. Mm-hmm. And so can you share your professional and parental, because it was also your son, right? From that, like the two hats of that.
Yes. My son, who is now 28, probably lost 10 friends between 18 and 25, many to drug overdose, suicide. And you know, how do you, and as parents, we don't want them to suffer because they're our children and we want to make it easier for them. But again, this is something we got to go through. We can't go around. So all I have been able to do, and the most recent one was just a couple years ago for my son, his very good friend committed suicide, is just to really sort of sit down and say, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Just because it's an uncomfortable conversation, but it's one that he needs the space to grieve. It can be very painful for me to hear it because he's my son and I don't want him to suffer. But it's also important that he know that I'm willing to sit with him in that time and in that space and be as comfortable as I can when he's uncomfortable. But it's tough.
One of the common things that people say in grief is when people are asked, you know, how are you feeling? How are you doing? Most people say, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. And in the grief work that I do, we say that fine means feelings inside not expressed. Mm-hmm. So it's really just a mask, right, that we say. So what are some things that you suggest then if you ask your son or your child or young adult or whether they're 5 or 15 or 25 and you ask them how they're doing or how they're feeling and they say, I'm fine, when do you press that or how do you press that? And do you just keep asking until they say otherwise?
Well, the other thing that, you know, I'm very intuitive. So I'll say something like, you know, how are you doing since you've lost such and such? And if they go, yeah, I'm doing really well, and they seem to be very dismissive of it, I'll say, listen, you know, if at any time you want to talk about it, I'm happy to have the conversation. Because it's a little bit tough when you don't want to have the conversation and somebody goes, well, just tell me, or just share with me. And you know, that's also a boundary. But I like to sort of create the opening of, listen, if you ever have a tough time with it, I'm more than happy, you know, give me a call. I'm more than happy to talk to you and sit with you during this. But we have to understand that some people, everybody deals with grief differently in their own way, and we need to honor that.
So what if you as the parent is uncomfortable with the topic of grief, period? And how do you get yourself more comfortable in having that conversation? Like if you're not confident in how you would respond or how you would support them, you may not be inclined to even ask. Mm-hmm. So how do you get to that point as a parent?
Right. Well, so what you're asking or what you're suggesting is that the parent feels very anxious and very fearful of doing that. And so when we do that, we only think about ourselves. So we pull in and we go, oh, I don't want to have this conversation. I don't want to feel uncomfortable and so forth. And what you were saying with your tuning forks to get your vibrational energy a little bit higher is for me to say, I'm okay to be uncomfortable, to just open the space for this person to express themselves. And what I tend to do when I'm uncomfortable is I try to listen more than speak, so that I don't say something that I wish that I hadn't said. So I open the opportunity for conversation unless they don't seem to want to have it. And then I assure them that, listen, I'm happy to talk to you if you want to. If not, no problem. Just want you to know that I'm just checking in and hope you're doing well.
Yeah, and you touched on it, but I think a lot of people think they have to have the solution, right? Or the fix it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just need to listen. And that's maybe the best medicine is just to listen. You don't even, you know, release that pressure from yourself to have to respond. And just like you said, just listen.
Yes. I like to say, just checking in, see how you're doing. So it's really light. Mm-hmm. And if they say, yeah, I'm doing as well as can be expected, I'll say, okay, just want you to know I was thinking about you. Maybe that's enough.
Right. What is one thing that you would like to scream to the world or wish that people knew about just grief in general, your personal grief that you've experienced? You had mentioned before we started recording, you've lost your parents, but what would you like to scream to the world?
With any time someone comes into your life that I would say touches your soul, when they leave this earth, there's going to be suffering and grief. That's just a natural part of it. I try personally not to pull in and suffer by myself. These are times where I can connect with other people. These are times when other people will come in to support me and I need to receive that. certainly with grief and any sort of suffering, there's meaning. I think about my parents and some of the wonderful things that they taught me and left me as a legacy. You know, some things not so great, but I can let those go. And to me, that's very meaningful. My sister and I talk about my mom all the time because she had some like silly habits. And then we'll notice ourselves doing the same silly thing. And we connect and we think of her in a positive light. I certainly, when I leave this earth, don't want my children every time they think of me to burst into tears. You know, I certainly know that they'll grieve me, but I also hope that I've left a lot of goodness in them, that they will think of me and smile, say some nice things. That's my hope anyway.
I'm pretty sure my kids will probably say, yeah, she was pretty weird. They say I'm weird now. So I take that as a compliment, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
So throughout your career, I mean, as you know, a critical care nurse, like what were some of the things before you had these tools and before you, you know, went to school and back to school for mental health, what were some of the things that you personally leaned on and that you've brought into your practice and kind of incorporated?
For me personally, self-care is key. I start every day with about 15 minutes of meditation just to sort of get myself grounded and sort of to find my center, if you will. I work hard, but I also take time. I exercise every day. For me, that's something that I really need to do. Just really helps me just disconnect for a little while. I'm very careful with my screen time. My first hour of the day, no screen time. And I shut it down a couple hours before I go to bed, just so that my mind can take a little bit of a break. I'm a big proponent of acupuncture, Reiki, I love quite a bit, massage. Not saying you need to do these every week, but sporadically, depending upon how you're feeling, incorporate some of these wonderful practices for just overall health and healing.
Did you start doing these things as you were a critical care nurse too within the 30 years or just in recent years?
I had a defining moment one night in the ICU. I was looking around at all of the patients that we had, and I realized some were just at the end of their lives. They were, you know, in their 90s, maybe they had a heart attack and so forth. But most of the patients that we had sort of put themselves there. They neglected their body. They were stressed out. They were smoking, diabetes. And I made a commitment to myself that if I were ever in the ICU, it wouldn't be because I did something to contribute to that. And then when I went over to mental health, I felt the same thing. I was like, boy, you know, me included. And I really start to invest more in my mental health. And I realized that when we're not mentally healthy, we're eventually going to become physically ill. And so I understand how important it is for me to manage, and this is my responsibility, my own stress and wellness so that I can stay healthy and happy.
You bring up a good point in that. Well, it just brings up the feeling in me that you can have, let's say there's a couple, they've been married 30, 40 years or even not, let's say it's just been maybe 5 or 10, like, or significant other, you don't have to be married, right? Mm-hmm. In partnership with someone. And you see these people just like one or the other, or maybe even both, just kind of going about life and just eating whatever they eat and drink whatever they eat, drink. And like you said, perpetuating the disease that's probably slowly manifesting until it becomes a full-blown heart attack or stroke or whatever the case may be that lands them in the hospital or in a medical crisis or terminal illness or whatever the case may be. And then one of them becomes a caregiver. Mm-hmm. So for those listening who may find themselves as a caregiver, who are looking at their significant other who has put themselves in that position and now feel maybe anger, resentment, mm-hmm. and to reconcile that as a caregiver, like it's like you're holding both the reality and the grief. Mm-hmm. The reality of what you're looking at in the situation of what it is and how that person got there. And then also, but I love this person. I want to care for them. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's a really difficult challenge for caregivers.
I agree. And what I suggest for people that are going through that is to consider having a therapist just to sort of you know, catharsis or venting with somebody that can help with some coping skills can be very, very healing. It's just hard when we have to go through it alone, particularly when they've got some sort of like dementia or something like that. It's, you know, these are why these support groups are so important, that we can sort of help each other. There's no way of eliminating it, or it's just getting some help to just sort of cope through it, cope with it, and also get other people that can help and support as needed. But I know my husband is 15 years older than I am. And as his health has started to decline, I have reached out to my own therapist more frequently just for support.
Let's say you see where the train is going and they're just not wanting to take the power back within themselves. They're not taking ownership of the situation. They're not doing what you would hope they would be doing. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in this situation listening, right? What do you do in that situation? Because you can't make somebody start working out. You can't make somebody seek mental health. You can't make somebody else do these things.
Correct. And what I see down here in Florida, we have a lot of people that obviously that retire and come down to Florida. But what I see typically is that neither husband or wife or partner has really prepared for sort of the end or the latter stages of life. For example, they have two or three homes, you know, and they're 80 years old. I mean, that's, and they've never really downsized and so forth. Then one or the other gets sick, and the one person is not only caregiving, but now has the two homes, you know, one in Michigan and one in Florida. And so what I say to them is, as you're starting to age, you know, downsize and get something manageable, manageable for two or one, because that may happen. But there's some things that we can do, regardless of what our spouse chooses, so that we're in a better position, maybe financially and logistically and so forth, so that we're preparing for this. But I can't tell you how many times I've met with people that with the three homes. It's just, you know, it's really unreasonable at 80.
Like you mentioned, though, you made a statement, something to the effect of planning for retirement or later years or the golden years or, you know, that time period in your life. We, you know, so many people spend so much time financially preparing for that, but you don't think about, what do I want my health to be at that stage? And what's in my power and control to address that starting today, so that when I get to that stage, I can enjoy it, right? Because what's the point of getting to that period of your life if you are sick and you can't enjoy it? Yes. And I think, yeah.
And one of the things that I work with people in is when we become physically ill, depending upon what's happening, that has started on the emotional, energetic level. So certain emotions will play out physically. And what happens is, you know, we're so afraid to deal with, I don't know, guilt or shame or trauma or so forth, but eventually they manifest physically. I cannot tell you how many patients that we had in the ICU, and they would say, "Can you believe I've had a heart attack?" And I would look at their chart and I'd be like, I sort of can. I mean, you have a lot of risk factors and you don't take care of yourself. And yet, you know, we think that just because we don't want to recognize it or acknowledge it, it's not going to have an impact on us. And it really does.
And everybody around them.
Yes. Yes. And so I have to think, not only is it going to affect me, but it's going to affect my spouse. It's going to affect my children. And, you know, we have to take responsibility for that. But many people don't, unfortunately.
No. What is one tip that you would give? I mean, you've shared a lot of tips, but what's one tip that you would give to someone listening who is hurting? Whether it's watching someone else suffer who's grieving, or whether they're grieving themselves.
Even when life is going fairly well, so we're going through our developmental stages and so forth, at every stage, it's a struggle. Because we haven't done it before. And once the kids go off to college, or we retire, or we get a new job, or whatever, I highly recommend, I started to see a therapist every now and then back in my 20s. Because even again, when there's nothing really particularly wrong, certain stages are very difficult for me. When my husband retired, that was a major change because and he was home all the time. I'm still working. And it, for me, that was a struggle. And I really felt like I needed somebody just to, other than my sister and my friends, and that's not their job, to be my therapist, but just talk through it. And I highly recommend everybody have a therapist, not just because I am one, because they're very, very helpful. Find somebody that you connect with and find somebody that can work with you when you're really going through a tough time so that it doesn't play out physically and affect your life and others around you.
Well, and when would you rather find a therapist? When you are in the emotional throes of something and it's like feels very immediate, like stat important, or when you can kind of ease yourself into the experience? Because for a lot of people, they may never have had an experience of working with a therapist too.
Yes. And it may be take a couple till they find somebody that's right for them. People will say to me all the time, can you recommend a good therapist? And I go, a good therapist is somebody that is right for you. So that's very important. And you're right. Let's not wait till we're right in the throes of a crisis and then we're scrambling to try to find somebody.
What would you say to people who don't really think therapy is for them because they just don't want to like just talk about, I just don't want to talk about it, talk, right? Like, what is your perspective of that? Like, do you incorporate other things or like action steps and things into your practice?
One of the things that I recommend for everybody is always have a self-help book around. I mean, there's thousands of them. And I always carry a book with me. And I read and read and read. And again, one, two pages at a time because I sort of have a busy schedule and so forth. But there's always some advice and some keys and some ways to cope that can be very, very helpful. So start that way where you start to just learn about yourself and emotions and how they affect the body and whatever you're interested in, meditation and so forth, and then move from there.
That has actually been one of the catalysts for my growth is reading self-help books, because it leads to, you know, it's like one book can lead to the next book to lead to the next book, or you end up down this rabbit hole where you learn maybe a new perspective. And, you know, it just, it really, it's like you didn't get to where you are overnight. You're not going to get to where you want to go overnight. So you might as well just take these incremental steps. And if it's reading two pages at a time, like you said, I mean, that's, it's, it has a compound effect, you know, just like grief and trauma, and it has this compound effect, but we can chip away at that, I think, by doing the things that you've talked about and mentioned in this episode.
Plus it helps us when we connect with other people. I can't tell you how many times I'll be out and about and somebody will say, thank you for recommending that book. And I have no memory of, and I go, what book was that? And they go, oh, this book, it was so helpful. I gave it to my sister. And this is how we, the power of our ripple in a positive way, other than complaining or, you know, connecting with people just over problems. We're actually connecting with people and recommending books and then talking about the books to each other and what we liked and what was helpful and so forth.
What is your grief and the grief that you've helped others work through taught you?
I have a very good friend that lost her son at 16. So it sort of was a freak accident. And so now he's passed away a little over 10 years. And I said to her one night, how do you deal with it now that it's 10 years? You know, it's not like it's been 2 months and so forth. And she said, you know, she said, we'll never get over it. She said, but we've learned to live peacefully next to it. And I thought that that was such an interesting way to describe. She said, you know, it's just something that's always going to be there. And you have to learn to be at peace with it living next to you. It's a wonderful question to ask people who are grieving 5 years down the road. Ask them, you know, what is it like? Like, what are the challenges 5 years later or 15 years later and so forth. It's something that not only is helpful for them and also helpful for us. I never forgot that that's how she described it. And I thought that that was so beautifully said.
One thing I talk about with my own experience is, so I lost my dad when I was 8 to cancer. So he was sick for almost 2 years before that. So I really didn't have much of a childhood. Mm-hmm. Had to grow up really fast. And my grandma had died the year before that, my mom's mom. Mm-hmm. And then my sister moved away. So there was just a lot of change and trauma, and things happened very back to back in the early part of my life. And one thing I say to people is that, especially with children who experience grief or trauma in childhood, is that they're going to grow up with it. Mm-hmm. So, and one thing that I hate that people say is that children are resilient. Like, I can't stand that when people say that, because mm-hmm. children don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. And they maybe just are able to adapt a little bit more easily than the adults, because we don't mm-hmm. have a capacity at that young age to wrap our head completely mm-hmm. around it. And so we adapt in how, because we're imaginative, right? As children, we're more imaginative. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I created a lot of stories in order to adapt to my experience. And so people mm-hmm. saw that as resilient and saw mm-hmm. that I was fine and I was adapting well. But you know, that stuff is stuck with you. You carry it with you and you grow mm-hmm. up with it, and it changes over time. And that's what I want mm-hmm. people to understand about child grievers, is that mm-hmm. it will never leave them. It is, you know, and there's so many people too, like I can recognize when I come across an adult who hasn't had probably a lot of loss in their life. They haven't had an experience that has completely flipped their life upside down or completely changed life for them. Mm-hmm. It's easier for me to see. And I think that's what helps build emotional intelligence too, is grief and trauma. I mean, would you kind of say that in a way?
Yeah. And I always think when I'm going through it, why me? And then I think, well, why not me? You know, because we think that that's something somebody else should experience. But I realize that it's important for me to experience too, because it's very, very painful. And it also helps me have a new understanding of other people that are going through it. But you're right. You have to learn to live next to it, because it doesn't go away.
Yeah. What gives you hope for the future?
I absolutely love what I do. And I feel it's very fulfilling. It's also very challenging. And for me, certainly my passion is, I just finished my second children's book. I write books. That's sort of my ministry. I enjoy sharing what I know about mental health. I hope to help people live happier and more fulfilling lives. And so that is sort of why I'm here.
I love that. In the last paragraph of your book, I just want to read it because I absolutely loved it. It was one of my favorite parts of the book. Remember, the mind does what you tell it to do. If you say, I choose to take care of myself because I'm worth it, your mind will be the best assistant you could hire. It will help you flow through your day with ease and less pain, suffering, and stress. Our perception is our reality. Make the choice to help others by first helping yourself. Mm-hmm. I think that beautifully wraps up our episode, but I do want to ask you about one more thing, because I found it interesting in what you also incorporate into your practice is Henry, your dog.
Yes, yes. In fact, I keep snapping my fingers because he's growling a lot.
He wants your attention, I suppose.
He does. He does. Yes. I started my practice initially with a therapy dog by the name of Max, and he worked with me. We had to put him down when he was 15. And, you know, it's just such a wonderful part of the practice. And so Henry is now his successor, and people just love to come in, and of course he loves his job, and that has been, it just helps people feel more at peace.
Since you brought up Max, can you discuss a little bit briefly how you navigated that pet loss of Max?
That was a tough one. He was the dog that we got when the children were little, and now the children are all, you know, out of the house and married and off. And then he worked with me for years and years and years. And so, you know, when he passed, it was like I had lost a limb. Mm. Talk about being in the waiting room. I mean, I had Henry at the time, but he was a puppy, and I just didn't know how to move forward. And I had difficulty sort of sitting through a session and so forth. And again, you know, he was a very important part of my life, and had to sort of work through that.
How did you work through that? Because I know there's a lot of people listening that probably have experienced pet loss. I know I've talked, pet loss has come up a lot in recent months for me.
And there are times where I still struggle. I have this little picture that I kiss before I go to sleep every night and so forth. And I just, you know, he taught me a lot. In fact, my first book, Healing Your Body by Mastering Your Mind, the reason that I wrote that book was I dedicated it to him because I felt like he was such an important part of the practice. And I wanted his legend, you know, I wanted him to live on. And so I sat down and I wrote the book and dedicated it to him. And that book has been very well received. So that was one of the ways that I honored him.
Well, and I'm sure it was very therapeutic for you to write it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote a little bit at the end about how we got him and how we named him and how he was very instrumental in our practice and so forth. And so wrote a little bit about him. And people love that part of the book.
So how did you know that you were ready for another dog?
Well, it was interesting. He was getting older and I wasn't sure that he was really wanted to practice with me anymore. We had a little dog door, which I do in my office, and he was starting to come in less and less. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll get another puppy and see if he can teach the puppy how to be a therapy dog. But by the time Henry came in, he really was getting very sickly and he just really didn't live too much longer. And that was really tough too, having a puppy and then also a dog sort of toward the end of his life. But you know, he was such a valuable part of not only my practice, but to me. You know, he was just a real special little guy.
Well, and I'm sure to your patients as well, the people that you worked with, your clients. Yeah.
Hundreds of emails and texts and cards after he passed. And that just also reminded me of how important it is for us to connect to each other and support each other when we're going through grief.
In a recent episode too, I mentioned pet loss had come up, and I said, you know, even if people listening they're in a place where they can't have a pet or they don't feel comfortable getting a pet because it's maybe more care than what they can handle at the time or whatever, just get a plant, get something to nurture, you know, give yourself something to nurture. And even maybe that small thing can help you create some purpose in your day, you know, if you're feeling a little low, if you're,
yeah, very fulfilling. In fact, when people sort of look me up after this episode, if they'd like to email me, I'd be happy to send them a copy of one of my books. That's just a thank you for listening today. We've talked to us about some really great topics.
Yeah. And where can people find you to connect with you?
My website is the best. DeniseSchoenwald.com. In there, I have a little 10-question mental health quiz, which is also very fun to do just to sort of see where you are. My books are listed. I have 3 currently. I'd be happy to send someone a copy of one of them if you email me. If you'd like an appointment, I'm licensed both in the state of Florida and nationally. So I see clients all over the United States. If somebody would just like to try a session and see how it works out, be more than happy. My calendar is online.
Wonderful. I will put the link in the show notes. And
sounds great.
Thank you so much for everything that you shared today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Great. And remember, when you unleash your heart, you unleash your life. Much love. From my heart to yours, thank you for listening. If you like this episode, please share it, because sharing is caring. And until next time, give and share compassion by being a heart with ears. And if you're hurting, know that what you're feeling is normal and natural. Much love, my friend. Thank you.